You're listening to the Albion Roar in association with oldfootballshirts.com on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and on our podcast. I am Alan Wares, and birthday boy AD, he's sunning himself somewhere in Italy, so he's going to come back with a different colour shine. Looking forward to it, and happy birthday for early in the week, mate. Brighton's three-match winning run came to a clunking end at Goodison Park last week. Lewis Dunk scoring an equaliser and an otherwise disappointing 3-1 defeat to Everton. Off the pitch, Albion's Socceroos stopper Matty Ryan was voted Premier League Player of the Month, although Chris Hughton missed out on winning Manager of the Month to Eddie Howe. Today, the club travels to Wales to face a Cardiff side that they really ought to be targeting for some points. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from football finance expert Kieran Maguire, while in the studio we have Brighton fan and film writer and director, welcome back after we worked it out earlier, 7 years, Warren Dudley. Warren, how are you?
Oh, I am very well. How are you?
Good to see you. Yes, you're looking fine and trim. And
trim.
Maybe
very,
slightly,
very kind.
Maybe slightly greyer than 7 years ago.
I think so,
but,
yeah.
So it's been a while. There's a number of football-related projects that
yes.
you've been involved in, but let's start with your Albion supporting history. I know
yes.
it's been a while since you've been on the show, so just remind those who might have remembered you being on first time, your first Albion experience.
I think it's one of those ones that my memory would be my dad taking me to the Goldstone to see us beat Manchester City 4-1 in about 81.
Right.
Something like that.
Is this the one that, the famous one that Jerry Ryan...
Do you know what details? I couldn't tell you details. I would have been 8.
Right.
So, but that is quite a strong memory. Standing on the southeast in mm-hmm. the southeast corner, which
yeah.
is where me and my dad stood for the entire time I went with him.
And for all you millennials, Manchester City were nothing like the team they are now. That they were then. Listen, they got relegated with us. In 83, so
yes, I did
alongside Swansea. And in fact, they got as far down as the third division as recently as 20 years ago. Mm. Guy Butters, actually, you could argue he sent them up because he missed a penalty in the playoff shootout when he was playing for Gillingham. Manchester City against Gillingham in the playoffs. This sounds ridiculous, doesn't it?
It was a massive game for them at the time, I remember.
Absolutely.
Dickhoff playing for them?
Probably. I mean, I lose track as to who was.
Yeah,
I lose track.
Yeah, me too.
So when you say you were 8 and you went to in 81 or so to the Goldstone, do you remember sort of. And bearing in mind we were a top division side, sort of badgering your dad to go, or did he drag you, or how did it happen?
Again, not really. I think we went on and off at the time. Not great memories of it. My first proper Albion memory is a nice easy trope. It is being here's the story quickly.
Go on.
Is that my dad went to every game in the cup run.
All
I
right.
didn't. I didn't go to any of them.
Okay.
Right? But he went with my granddad.
Yep.
And a pair of, like to drink, the pair of them on football days. And but in January, my dad had booked a family holiday in Spain for May. So my dad went to all the games, went to Highbury,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't go to the final, missed it, because we were in Spain. So me and my dad were wandering around this little town in Spain looking for a bar with a radio.
Mm-hmm.
Again, shows how long ago it was. And we didn't find one. And we were on the plane, and the guy... The pilot said, anyone interested in the FA Cup final score, it was a 2-2 draw, and which meant we got to deck the house out on the Thursday night in blue and white. We had all the scarves, we had the family round. Amazing. And I went to my bedroom and cried at half time. I sat in my bedroom, age 10, burst into tears.
Because?
3-0 down, weren't we, at half time, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
And that, I think, is when this started.
So it was actually on Cup Final Day?
Pretty much, I think, yeah.
Or Cup Final Replay Day.
Yeah, sporadic memories
before
then.
Because you feared a 7-0 thrashing.
Well, yeah, exactly. And from then on, that's it then. That's football, isn't it?
It is.
Disappointment. And it's...
Yeah, but I would like to think probably these days you wouldn't actually cry if we were 3-0 down at half-time.
No.
You might, might do something beginning with C, but but not cry. So, I've got to be honest with you, I don't ever recall crying at the Albion losing, but it really does actually, following the Albion covers every emotion from A to Z and back again, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's football's such a strange thing, isn't it? It's such a hard thing to describe to people who aren't into it.
Yes.
So why do you go? Do you enjoy going to the Albion? Don't know, not really. But you enjoy the match, though. Well, yeah. Sort of.
Yeah.
And
yeah, but we won. Yeah, but it wasn't that great. Yeah.
And you care. You seem to care more about losing than winning. And it's such an interesting... but I wouldn't miss it. And it's the thing I'll never stop.
But the thing is, when you say you got dragged to the football... Yes. Well, you say you went to the football at 8, but it wasn't until you were 10 that actually the bug bit you, and then you weren't even there. Do you recall... I mean, was it the fact you knew it was a big game? And had it registered it was a big game for you?
I think, yeah. Like I say, we had the family round, and it was a big event, wasn't it? And, and the classic, the old Thursday night cup final replays was a tradition, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And my dad got to see the game, and it was all so exciting, and then it was such a massive anticlimax.
Yes.
And that was... you know, we thought because of everything, we were just bound to win because we'd, you know.
We played a lot better. We played more expansive, and I think United just picked us off, didn't they?
The other sweet thing is my dad got his friend, who was still wasn't in Spain, to video it for us. So I've got a VHS of the whole of grandstand from like 9 o'clock in the morning right through to this. It's just great.
Brilliant.
You know, it's a dusty old thing now. But
Okay, so you make out this is because actually, and we were talking about there's a nice sort of parallel here, which is we've had many conversations with Louis Miles, who's the director of Kaiser, and he's got another film coming out, and there's a kind of parallel here. He was born on Cup Final Day.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah.
Oh,
well. So, I mean, this is terrible. I was at senior school when it was the Cup Final, and we were all allowed to wear Albion colours. You know,
yeah,
I was at Dorothy Stringer, which is all black and white with yellow, you know, trim within the. I'm describing a school uniform like a school kit here. I played for the football team, black and white stripes. It was a Newcastle looking kit, and I understand still is. But yeah, we were actually allowed to. I mean, I'm thinking, hang on, I was at senior school, and there's obviously people who are much, much older than me. But then Louis is in here, and he's sort of like being a world famous dude, and he was born on Cup Final Day. You think something doesn't scan there.
That's terrible.
It is terrible.
Getting old, aren't we?
well, yes. I mean. But okay, so if you started your Albion fandom at the age of 8, started at 8 and it really bit you at 10. So in that time, and I've got a sort of guns ahead here.
Yep.
Who's your all-time favourite player, and who is your best player? Because they're not necessarily one and the same, are they?
No, all-time favourite player. I think in life, everything, the stuff you soak up most is when you're about 17, 18. All your music tastes, all your comedy tastes, all your football love. I think that starts and it soaks. And I still listen to all the music I listened to when I was age. And Gary Nelson.
Yeah.
Gary Nelson was, and him and Bremner up front, but Nelson was my just utter hero that year.
Goldstein Gaz.
Yeah, it just seemed so good. And that team, I loved that team so much with Ruvi and Dublin and all that lot.
Mm-hmm.
That was seemed like my team when I was, that was 88, was it?
87, so 88, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd have been 16, 17.
Sure. So were you there at Brentford when Nels beat?
I wasn't. No, I didn't go. Oh. No.
Did you ever watch?
Oh yes, I've seen a few games. Yes.
Yeah. So Gary Nelson, he was your favourite player, and also okay, who do you think was best?
I think. Look, I mean, it's an easy one, really. But seeing Vicente in an Albion shirt, I know I'm sure everyone says it, but it just seemed so surreal at the time. He just seemed so much better than everybody else that it was. It was just fantastic to watch him, and you know, we were so lucky to have him for that brief time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know? Yeah, I mean, I actually remember being on holiday in Barcelona at the time that Vicente was with us, and talking to this fellow, you know, the bloke who was sorting out a hotel room and what have you. And I said, "Oh, you know, he clearly see he was a Spain fan. I'm not sure. Oh, he must have been a Barcelona fan. I don't think he was Espanol." But I did say, and I said, look, you know, have you wondered what's happened to Vicente? He said, oh, Vicente. Yeah, where is he? I said, he's playing for us in the second division in England.
Amazing.
What? In Spanish, what's he doing there? Well, remember Gustavo Poyet? Oh yeah. That, you know, so he kind of fallen off the radar in Spain. To some people, but turning up in the second division in Brighton.
Yeah.
And it's probably the likes of Vicente that actually, even before we got to the Premier League, really put us on the map, certainly within Spain.
I mean, we had
some Spanish players, not necessarily those. I mean, there were bit part players for those that were at Barcelona and Valencia, but it was Vicente that sort of like, you know, woke a lot of Spanish fans up to what we were doing.
Just seeing him amongst our regular Championship players was just, you know, great. And just him picking out passes that no one else was seeing.
Absolutely.
Even Will Buckley, though, I remember watching those two thinking, you know, that's all right. Buckley seems to understand, but a lot of them didn't.
Yes. The other person I reckon that Vicente sort of best linked up with, of all people, was Ashley Barnes.
Yeah, there you go.
They seemed to have a better understanding of what was going on.
Yep.
And the rest were sort of like, well, the thing is, you just give the ball to Vicente and you didn't have a clue what he was going to do. He probably didn't. And the rest of them are going, what are you going to do?
And he didn't play in the Palace second leg.
No.
Didn't play him.
No.
It was a strange old night that was, wasn't it?
No, let's not go there. Let's just remember Gary Nelson.
Yeah, remember Nelson Brenner. Nelson,
Vicente,
Nelson, let's forget
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yes. Okay, Earlier today, I caught up with football finance expert Kieran Maguire. There's a number of things to talk about, including the Everton game from last week and the Man City stuff that's going on. So here's what he had to say. Kieran, how are you?
I'm reasonably good, Alan. I've got only one leg that works at present, which causes a bit of dampener on things. But
what have you done?
I've had it peeled. I've had my knee peeled back, and they've inserted a piece of gauze in which apparently good cells are going to grow in it and replace the bits of my knee which are missing.
You make it sound like something out of Star Trek.
Yeah, I do look a bit like Steve, or it look a bit like Steve Austin's leg from the old $6 million man scene.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I'm held together by a brace at present.
but I think you're a bit better. You're in slightly better shape than a man barely alive.
Just about, yes.
Okay. So what is before we get on to start talking Albion stuff, what's the prognosis? How long before you're playing football again?
I've been told I've got to retire from cricket and running, which are my main sports in terms of participation, but I'm hoping to be walking in 4 weeks.
Okay, well, good luck, mate, and Connect Four it is from here on in onwards. So,
thank you.
Okay, well, listen, there's obviously the big news of Der Spiegel, the German magazine's revelations about Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain have come out this week. We'll talk about that in a minute. But for the first bit, let's talk about the Albion at Everton. Did you watch the game? Did you manage to get there despite only having one leg?
Yeah, I managed to see that particular match. I'm fortunate I work in Liverpool, so it's not too far away for me.
Sure. Let's hear your sort of summary of it, because, you know, certainly the highlights don't make for good viewing.
Sometimes you've got to admit you're playing against a good side who are having a very good day. And I think that was the case in respect of Everton. They were faster than us. They were stronger. They were winning all the 50-50s. And they soundly beat us. And there's no disgrace from losing to a side that have invested so heavily in the squad in the last couple of years, far more than the Albion have managed. And of course, they are an established Premier League team. So it was a defeat. No defeats are pleasant to put up with, but we couldn't go away and say, well, we had any bad luck there. We were simply soundly beaten on the day.
Sure. The person who seemed to shine the most was Richarlison, who, he was getting a steal on everyone, wasn't he?
Yes, he's exceptionally quick. I think that was shown in the first goal where he just burst through. It was a superb goal, superb assist as well. And that came from our corner. So, you know, for those people who say that we don't attack enough, the danger is that if you go to places like Everton, and also I was at the Etihad when we lost there, when we conceded two goals on the basis of counter-attacking from the opposition, who were simply swifter and stronger than us. He's a very good player. He looked good for Watford last season. I think he's playing in a slightly more advanced role than last season as well. And I think he'll do well for Everton, dependent upon whether the supply lines are good enough for him.
Absolutely. But then, sort of shock against shock, we managed to score an away goal again. I think that it had been sort of noted that Everton were a little bit weak in the air at the back, and so it proved. I mean, Lewis Dunk did actually quite well for his header, bullet it in from 4 yards out.
Yeah, I think it was a well-worked routine. And one of the good things about this season is that we're now able to score from set pieces, which was very evident that we struggled with last season in terms of both conceding and scoring. So clearly a lot of work has been done on the training ground. It was quite a smart little routine. Good ball in from Solly, and Lewis Dunk, was a very strong header. It was against the run of play, but sometimes if you don't create many chances, you have to make the most from the ones that you do create. And that has been a feature of our play this season.
Absolutely. I mean, we talk about sort of corner routines that, you know, last season we were, you know, absolutely shocking at. And we thought, oh, my God, we haven't learned our lesson, because even against Watford on the first day of the season, we still managed to concede from a corner. But, you know, touch wood. I mean, we haven't actually conceded from a corner. In my memory, we haven't conceded from a corner since that first day of the season, apart from Everton's first goal being from our corner. So there's obviously some improvement gone there.
That's right. And I think that's a lot to do with the drills and people taking up the roles and responsibilities that they've been given by Chris and the coaching team. And also remember that when we first arrived in the Premier League, it was a case of knitting quite a few new players together with the existing members of the squad. And that means that it's a time, you know, it's an exercise which does take a bit of time. And we certainly improved over the course of last season. And it now seems to be one of our strengths, is that we can defend corners and set routines a lot better than last season. And that, I think that's absolutely essential for a club such as the Albion, who aren't going to set the world alight in terms of the number of goals scored, that if we can reduce the number of goals that we're conceding and you know, pick up a few clean sheets, which could make all the difference at the end of the season.
So it's quite a scrap, isn't it? Because what's, in terms of a scrap, what seems to be apparent, certainly for the second half against Everton, like you say, they were stronger, they were better. But even when we did get the ball, and this is a pattern that's gone on since, certainly for the Newcastle game, the Wolves game, the West Ham, I mean, yes, we won, and yes, we'll take the points and what have you, but it doesn't paper over the fact that actually our ball retention in a few recent games has been pretty poor. That's not to say that we're in a position to batter people, but, you know, Wolves kept the ball very well against us, and yet, you know, is there anything that sort of springs to mind to you that actually makes you think, well, okay, we can defend off the ball, we're very good on the ball, we just don't look like we know what to do with it?
I think we have struggled with retention, and I think a part of that is the fact that we are a cautious team, so therefore the number of options for a player when he's looking forwards are going to be restricted. I also think that we miss Davy Proper a huge amount, because one of his strengths, and you know, it's sort of a classic continental player, was that he's very comfortable on the ball in terms of distribution, and that's missing. I mean, Behram Kayal has played well, and Dale Stevens is good, sort of got a close contact, is good at screening players, but you know, that those players have come from a slightly lower level, where they're used to giving the ball away and then getting it back again.
So yeah, I mean, that point is that along the lines of the second and third goals for Everton, which were clearly very much with the run of play, but you know, the third one, a howler from Lewis Dunk, which is rare, but you know, we can't really afford to do that from here on in, can we?
No, you know, we all know that every goal is precious, and it was an error of judgment of his, and it put Shane Duffy in a really awkward position with Richarlison running at him, and I don't think anybody would fancy that. And the lad took the goal very well, but it was a silly mistake. You know, we don't tend to make many of those. I think the only one I can think of similar from last season was at home to Huddersfield, where Shane Duffy did a poor back pass. But one of the things I have noticed since the move up to the Premier League is that mistakes are punished far more rigorously than we were used to. You know, if it had gone to somebody of the calibre of Chris O'Grady playing for Barnsley, then you're on a 50-50 at worst. But the difference in the Premier League is that things are very, very clinical.
Absolutely. I've got the feeling even Fulham managed to capitalise on if I remember, it was also a Lewis Dunk mistake. So, but I think it was also put in a bit of a pickle himself, in as much as the ball was played up to Stevens. And the frustrating thing that we're feeling here at the moment is that, you know, no one tells Stevens to turn, go forward, because the goal's up that way. You know, just, it's, you're right, there's the cautious play, but then there's the play which has actually then got his teammate back into trouble. And, you know, it would be nice to think that we could sort of, you know, very soon start actually sort of telling our players to turn and go forward and see what they can do with it.
Yes, I mean, we're not creating many chances, and I think we've been fortunate to a degree in that we've been very good at, when we have had chances, and actually turning them into goals. But that's not going to continue all season. You're going to have patches where Glenn's shooting boots aren't there, and if that does arise, then it is a concern. It would be nicer to have matches where we're getting a greater proportion of the play in the opposition half, rather than sort of the two banks of four doing their job, but doing it very well. But it's not exciting, but as far as I'm concerned, that's the least of the issues. But you cannot keep on hoping to scrape 1-0 victories ad infinitum.
No. Now, the thing is, here you are, phoning in on a radio show here, and yet probably we made the news, or a Brighton fan made the news last week with a contention that Houghton should step aside. But, I mean, as much as we've been moaning about how the team's playing, do you feel that you'll sort of have an opposing view to that particular phone-in chap?
I think the vast majority of Brighton fans were just embarrassed by what they heard. Chris Hughton has been given a brief by Tony Bloom and Paul Barber, and that brief is to keep Brighton and Hove Albion in the Premier League, and it's going to be incremental gains. So it is to a certain extent a case of grinding out results, taking our chances when they arise, but also accepting the fact of where exactly we are in the dog-eat-dog world of the Premier League. And we are in the bottom six in terms of resources, and it's our job, or Chris's job, to make sure that we are in the top three of that bottom six come the end of the season. And as far as I'm concerned, he's doing a fantastic job. It's not just the fact that he is, without doubt, the nicest guy in football. I think he uses the strengths of the squad to their greatest. It's all very well saying attack, 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 but I went to the Etihad, as Ed said to you earlier. We gave the ball away twice, and we conceded the ball. We conceded two goals as a result of that. We simply do not possess players of the calibre of Richarlison and Sigmundsson, and look at City and so on. We are an honest working, hard working team. There's a little bit of flair on occasion. We know that Izquierdo and Anthony Knockhart can take on defenders, and we're hoping that will be more. Nobody wishes that this team plays cautious football all the time and just tries to grab a clean sheet. Remember, if you look at the side that we had at Everton, the vast majority of those players had played in the Championship, where they were playing superb football. So given that the majority of the players are the same, the manager is the same, you then have to ask yourself, well, what is the big difference? And the difference is simply the quality of the opposition.
There is an improvement from each and every player that was playing in the Championship that's now playing in the Premier League. But yes, I mean, the difference between what we had in the Championship and what we've got in the Premier League versus the opposition in the Premier League is vast, because we were the top side in the Championship and we're far away not the top side in the Premier League. So it's slightly mitigated by the fact that our players have improved and most of them have stepped up. And I think that is actually a credit to Chris Hughton as well, no?
Yes, so I think that's a very valid point. What is the job of the manager? It's to deal with the players on an individual basis, sort of psychologically, physically, tactically and technically. And you look at nearly everybody in that team which came up from the Championship, and I can't think of anybody that's not really as good in that division. I think Anthony Knockhart probably had a bit of a struggle, but he's had some personal issues to deal with, and by his own admission, he's sort of struggled with certain aspects of his game. But other than that, the defence has been superb. I think we've got an upgrade in the goalkeeper, the midfield. The majority of them are delivering, and Glenn Murray continues to defy science and age and all of those processes.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking of things which are being defied, now moving away from the Albion, like I say, let's stick your football finance expert hat on. There's revelations that have come out this week in the German magazine Der Spiegel, making claims that not only have Manchester City, who've previously been fined under FFP rules, they've been found guilty of that, but there's further considerations to take into account. Now, let's say, with your finance expert hat on, what do you make of what has been said in Der Spiegel and what they haven't said?
I'll be honest, Alan, there's nothing that has been revealed this week that I didn't already know. It was simply a case of, if you were prepared to sort of grind your way through the different sets of companies involved, that it was all there. I think the most disappointing thing from Manchester City's point of view is this Project Longbow or Long Arrow, whatever that they've been talking about, which appeared to be an aim of using some fairly creative accounting methods to sort of circumnavigate financial fair play issues. But we still don't know whether those particular transactions and the aim of those transactions, for people that aren't familiar, was A, to artificially enhance money coming in terms of income sources, and B, to suppress costs. Now, if those had already been discovered by the financial fair play inspectors, that those could have been taken into account when Citi were fined €60 million in 2013. So for me, that's the one big outstanding issue, is that it could be that actually this is not news to UEFA. It simply hasn't been published before, and that Der Spiegel may have got the wrong end of the stick, in the sense that City have already been punished for this. So are they actually trying to get sort of double jeopardy on this particular issue? I'm not condoning the approach taken by City. At the same time, I'm not quite sure who the losers are in this. Because it's money coming from one hand of the Sheikh to another part of the Sheikh's empire.
I think in terms of who's losing, I think it's probably everyone bar Manchester City, because let's face it, they are at the moment in English football untouchable.
They're untouchable because they've got a fantastic coach and they're playing fantastic football. Manchester United pay more wages. Manchester United have got players who have cost more on an individual basis than Manchester City. I think you've got to give some credit to the coaching staff there. Yes, certainly they have been able to compete at the top tier in terms of player recruitment and player retention. But that is also something you could level at Juventus and Real Madrid and Barcelona, all of whom are top of their individual leagues. City have just done it for us here in England, and have played football that I've never seen before. In any form of English football, and part of me says, regardless of what I do for a living, I actually go to football just to watch the game. Mm. And I think Pep Guardiola is a superb coach, and that is the main reason why City are doing well. Certainly, they're able to compete with United and Liverpool and Chelsea financially, which they weren't able to do before. Have they done it in an inappropriate way? Yeah, probably they have, and they have been fined for it, and they've had to cut the wage levels. They've had restrictions on transfer fees they've been able to pay, and also they've had restrictions in terms of their squad size for UEFA competition. So the sanctions that were given to them were actually quite severe during the course when they're on the naughty step.
Sure, sure. Now, the point is that, I've read the English translation. My German is a bit rusty. I've read the English translation of the Der Spiegel. It's in four parts. And I've got to say that from my point of view, from the layman's point of view, I found that the article itself was pretty thin on detail. There was certainly a lot of accusations. There was certainly a lot of, I'm sure that, none of them are actually sort of out and out lies, far from it, and things that can or can't be proved. But it seemed a bit skimpy on detail. But the thing is, they've also got Paris Saint-Germain in their sights as well. I mean, is there a similar consideration that's gone on at PSG that has also happened at Manchester City? Well, I mean, can you compare and contrast the two FFP administrations here?
Yeah, I think the accusation which has been made at both of those clubs is that they've undertaken sponsorship deals with friendly parties in order to generate more income. And the amounts that they've been paid by these sponsors are far in excess of you would expect to pay, given the market position of A, the club, and B, the other party. And that's certainly a constant theme between Manchester City and PSG. And that has given the clubs the ability to go out into the transfer market. And in the case of PSG, they recruited Neymar last season, and they've signed Mbappe this season. But again, if you actually sort of look at it on a more granular level, the amount of money that PSG spent on Neymar last season, remember Mbappe was only on loan, that was less than Manchester United spent on players and also Manchester City spent on players. Mm. So they weren't the biggest spenders in Europe. They just spent the greatest amount on a single individual. And that's what got all the people talking. And personally, I find a lot of the sniping coming from La Liga I just find that a bit ridiculous, given that Real Madrid historically have been a state-sponsored football club and given huge financial advantages in terms of access to money and funding to make them a great club over a period of time. So I think there's an awful lot of jealousy involved in this, and that jealousy comes from the fact that teams in La Liga have been so used to being dominant in Europe, and that's no longer the case.
Now, bearing in mind what Der Spiegel have said this week, and bearing in mind what you know, you said yourself this was, it was hardly sort of jam-packed with revelations from your point of view. Where do you believe you see this story going? I mean, do you see UEFA sort of clamping down on these two again, or do you think that there's hot air? I mean, sitting with your crystal balls next to your gammy leg, where do you see this story going?
I think the latest we have in respect of PSG is that UEFA sort of wanted to close the case, but they are being forced to reopen it due to pressure coming from Spain. I think there will be pressure on them to become more transparent as to the justification between the in respect of the fines given to both PSG and to Manchester City in respect of their what happened in 2013 when the first set of FFP rules were breached, to see whether these revelations as such, whether they'd actually been already spotted by the inspectors and therefore they were part of the overall sanctions that were given at the time. In due course, I think the whole issue will just be dropped because we will find something else to get morally indignant about, which is the nature of football today. Everybody seems to want to be angry in respect of an issue or another issue. There are plenty of other English football clubs who have breached FFP rules, and they're not getting the same level of stick. And only yesterday, Everton were fined £500,000 in respect to sort of inducements made to young players to try to get them to sign for the club. And that's not kicked up any fuss whatsoever, but it's still a breach of rules. It's still cheating. It's still inappropriate behaviour. Manchester City are an easy target because of the nature of their owners, and people want to take a moral stance in respect of those. And if they want to do that, you can see the justification of that. But ultimately, Alan, for me, it's a couple of hours away from home, a pie, meeting my mates. And that's what football should be about. And in an ideal world, I wouldn't have a job because nobody would be interested in all of this financial nonsense.
And that would be an absolute travesty for society as a whole. Kieran Maguire, thanks very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Raw.
Anytime, Alan.
Yeah, that was Kieran Maguire talking to me earlier. Hopefully he'll be back up and running soon. Good luck with all your trials and tribulations with your leg there. You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB or on our podcast. This show is brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and we have a shirt of the week. And Warren has got a copy of this. AD normally prints his out, but then I don't have a printer. So what I've done is I've sent him an electronic version of it. So Warren, describe this shirt for us, mate.
Right. I can describe it as one of those classic Lee South American looking shirts.
Right.
They don't seem to have any rules on how much sponsorship you can put on a shirt. It's a white affair with a nice, thick, chunky, dark green stripe down the middle of it. And yeah, I like it. It's got, again, it could only be Spain or South America. It's one of those shirts, isn't it?
And sure. It looks like a Formula One shirt. There's so many adverts on it.
It does, yeah. I mean, it's you wonder what the rules are. They must have them.
Yes.
But, yes, I don't...
Any guesses, then? I mean, okay, I'm going to give it to you. It's in the Americas, so pick a country.
Peru.
Nearly, but not quite. Okay, the shirt that Phil has chosen for us this week is... it's the 2002-2003 home shirt of Liga MX side Santos Laguna. The Liga MX is the top flight of football in Mexico, and Santos are the current champions of the 2018 Liguilla Clausura, which is the second half of the season of two short tournaments. Or something like that.
That was going to be my second guess.
Of course it was. Yeah. It was on the tip of your tongue, wasn't it?
Really was,
all
yeah.
the time.
It was that or Peru.
All the time. Phil was recently on holiday in Hershey in Pennsylvania. Attending a vintage car show. It does get better, this story. I found this shirt, he says, for sale on one auto jumble stall. I think I can count a total of 8 sponsor adverts across the front and back. Santos have a couple of nicknames, Los Guerreros, the Warriors, and Los Verdiblancos, the Green and Whites. They play at the 29,237 capacity Estadio Corona in the city of Torreon in the northern Mexican state of Coahuila. I hope that's how it's pronounced. If not, I've probably just sworn. I do apologise. They were formed after a succession of mergers, relocations and renamings, taking the name Santos Laguna in 1983. They climbed the leagues and have established themselves as one of the top sides in Mexico. Christian Benitez is probably the most recognisable name to have played for Santos. In 2009-10, he turned out 30 times for Birmingham in the Premier League, scoring 3 times.
Sorry, did you say a succession of murders?
Mergers.
Oh, OK.
As verbal typos go, that's a pretty good one, actually.
I enjoyed it.
It could have been.
It could have been, absolutely.
As a plot for your next film.
Yeah, who's to say?
Going back a little further, you may recall Jared Borghetti.
Nope. No.
He was with Bolton Wanderers for the 2005-06 season. He is the all-time top scorer for Santos and the second highest goal scorer for the Mexican national side. You can catch up with all of Phil's 94,000-plus shirts at oldfootballshirts.com. I say every week he supplies us with a shirt of the week, and thank you very much indeed. And also, as I said at the top of the show to AD, happy birthday to Phil, although Phil is a lot older than everyone else on the planet. Hope you have a great weekend in Cardiff, mate, and bring home the points. We'll just move on to what Warren's been up to lately, but a couple of things on the notice board. First things first, well done to former Albion fullback Don Shanks, who completed the New York Marathon in 4 hours, 11 minutes, 33 seconds. He was running for, there's a charity called Four Stand Bowls, and he was also running for the Alzheimer's Society. Congratulations, it was his first ever marathon at the age of 66. As he points out, a really dumb thing to do, but I think he enjoyed it. In fact, he looked in decent nick when we saw the videos of it. And if you'd still like to support Don in this for supporting, raising money for the Alzheimer's Society, go to Don Shanks' Facebook page or go fund me and search for Alzheimer's Society Don Shanks. But well done him. The other thing we're going to say is just a reminder that on Wednesday, the 12th of December, AD and I will be hosting an evening with Andy Rollings and Chris Catlin live at the Rialto Theatre in Dyke Road in Brighton. Tickets are going to be £8 and £6. We're going to do record a couple of shows there. The pair of them have a multitude of stories to tell. From all their times when Rollings started under Brian Clough, was signed under Brian Clough. Chris Catlin, who was a defender, who was 100 by the time he turned up here anyway, went on to become Albion manager and still holds the record for the fewest number of defeats in a season. So do come along. Like I say, tickets £8 and £6. An evening with Rollo and Cat, Wednesday, 12th December at the Rialto Theatre in Brighton. Warren, do you fancy that, mate?
Yes, I'm in. As I said to you on Facebook, I'd love to like that. That sounds all right.
You must remember, in that case, by the time you were really getting into football, Chris Catlin must have been the manager at the time.
Yeah, I don't remember him playing, but as manager, yeah.
So when
yeah.
you say you got sort of, you know, Gary Nelson was your all-time favourite player, I mean, do you remember the players immediately before that?
So between the cup final and that team.
Yeah, where he had to actually shed a lot of that.
It was within that time, wasn't it?
Yeah. Which
would have been, I guess would have been the remnants of the cup final team, the Gattings.
Absolutely.
And the Stevens, and would have hung around for a bit on there, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, Stevens went immediately. Gattings stayed till the playoff final in 91 and beyond, didn't he?
Didn't he? Yeah, well.
But I mean, if AD was here, he would be still purring over Steve Penny. Do you remember?
Of course, yes. I've got a Steve Penny story. Is that when I was 13, I broke my. I was playing football, and a mate of mine, Daryl, smacked a penalty at me. I was only sort of playing a goal, and it broke my wrist. And I fell back on my wrist after it had broken it. Agony. And so I was down the wreck in New Haven, went home, and said to my mum and dad, look, showed them this swollen wrist. And my dad said, my mum said, we need to get into the hospital. And my dad said that Northern Ireland are playing tonight at the World Cup, 86. So we looked at each other, me and my dad. So we stayed at home and watched Steve Penny play in the 86 World Cup.
While you had a broken arm.
And so we went to the hospital about 10:30. That's me and my dad for you. So we stayed. I stuck my clutching my ever getting greener and greener wrist
Well, which was suitable since Northern Ireland were playing.
So there you go, perfect. So yes, are we? Yes. So
there you go. Another story. Karen Hasted, just for you, a Steve Penny story. Are you happy now? There you go. Talking of all things Albion and yourself, let's start off with what we were talking about before when you're on the show 7 years ago. There's a piece of your artwork in Dick's Bar, isn't there?
There is, yes. Tim Herbert, a friend of mine, and I started chatting about 8 years ago about the potential of this art project, a huge mosaic, and it seemed like pie in the sky at the time. It seemed like a crazy, crazy idea to get involved in.
They're usually the best ones.
Like I do, I just said, yeah, let's do it. And then 6 months later, and hours and hours and hours of collation of photographs, we produced something I think is an amazing thing at the Amex. Yes, the mosaic is mine and Tim's, and really, really proud of it. And in fact, it's still there. It's lovely. And the club.
Absolutely.
The club.
Needs cleaning. I mean, when you see
it, I haven't been into Dick's for ages.
Have you not? No. I mean, it's not as though it looks grubby, but if someone actually did if you had an art restorer, you know, you got their special chemicals out.
What's amazing, there's kids on there who are like 12, 13 now. That's what's amazing, isn't it? So it's a proper little piece of Albion history, that. And
there's two pictures. I know there's two pictures of me on there, and I know where they are.
Yeah.
And one of them is a picture of me holding my then day-old niece, who now, and I've told this story on air before. I'm sorry, Abby, if you're listening, I'm sorry about this, but one of the first things I did when my niece was born, my brother's daughter was born, was I went and got her a pink Albion romper suit. His wife immediately went and took it back. No football stuff in this house. No, Uncle Alan, no, you're not going to be doing this. Fast forward 7 years, you cannot get her out of her Albion kit.
Oh, there you go. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
It works.
It's the DNA.
It is,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and actually, I will have to point out that next time we're in the, if she's ever in Dick's Bar, I'll have to say, look, there's you with Uncle Al there. So
that's great.
But yes, no, it's a fabulous piece of artwork.
Yeah, and the fact it's still up there is lovely, and I hope the clubs leave it up for as long as
absolutely.
Possible. They couldn't have been lovelier at the time. You know, because there was a competition, I don't know whether you remember, do the artwork around the concourses.
Mm-hmm.
And we just missed the deadline. So we said, we've got this idea. And I spoke literally, was dealing with Martin Perry back and forwards. And he said, we love it, but I'm really sorry, you've missed out. Then I got an email back from him saying, look, there's a chance we've got a wall in Dick's Bar.
All right.
So we may be able to give you that. So it kind of went from there, really. So they were, you know, great, and it's
fabulous.
A good piece, I think. I'm pretty proud of it. It's lovely because Attila's poem's down the right.
There's Attila's poem down that side. There's the portrait of the pop art type portrait.
That's it.
Of Dick. And yes, there's. I mean, it's very much Dick's Bar.
It is.
And it's for me, it's a perfect addition to it. So, and I've got my own relatively miniature version of it, which I made a point of framing, and I still have.
I've still got one framed. Peter Ward signed mine. I got him to sign a few, and I kept one for myself.
Brilliant, brilliant. No, it's a wonderful piece, and very much a part of the fabric of that particular thing.
I'm incredibly proud of it. We have our beer in the West Lower after the game. Every week, and as you walk back down past the ground, you can kind of look up and see it staring. It's nice.
Well, to be fair, actually, I think most of the things hanging up in Dick's Bar at the moment are the things that were there originally in 2011. So it's nice that kind of thing is still there. So that's a brilliant thing. But you've also been busy with a feature film this summer.
I have, yes. Well, I say this summer. I mean, look, the Bromley Boys has been ongoing for, you know, I started the Bromley Boys probably the year after I was in last.
What did you do?
How do you mean?
What part did you play in the Bromley Boys?
I'm the screenwriter.
Yes.
So basically, a friend of mine called TJ, a Crystal Palace fan.
Oh dear.
He, I'm surrounded by him in that project. Is
I suppose around Bromley. You
exactly.
Would be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he optioned this book called The Bromley Boys, which is like a fan diary of the 1969-70 season from a lad who's 15. And when Bromley... Yeah, true. They were the worst team in England.
So it is actually based on
all the characters are real in the Bromley Boys. Yeah, it's all... So the book is kind of... is chapter one, home to Sutton. Chapter two, away to Corinthian Casuals. Chapter three, home to Enfield. So it's just... there's no story. Yeah, there's a story, but there's no
there's
real...
there's a narrative, though.
There's not a movie arc.
Right, okay.
So I've added, you know, as we started the screenplay, more and more was getting added, turn it into a movie, because obviously films have to have certain... beats, and I have to have certain things. You need a romance in it, you need a story arc, you know, bullet points where the story hits. Didn't have any of that in the book, so I just added it all. But there's loads of bits I've taken out of Dave's book, But Dave Roberts, the main character, yeah, he exists. I chat to him every day. He's a lovely, lovely bloke.
Palace fan?
Bromley fanatic, obviously, actually loves Bromley Football Club. Like, I've never known anyone love a football club. I highly recommend Dave's books. There's, yeah, the Bromley Boys and his recent one, Home and Away.
Okay.
Which was a following, he went to live in America for 30-odd years and he came back with his American wife and took her to a season of Conference South games. And it is
such a fun,
it's such a funny book. And he's great and he's very funny. I was quite privileged to use it, really. That was a scary, sending that script to him the first time was scary because obviously I'm writing about his mum and dad and these people existed and I'm writing about...
Does he know it's funny, this kind of, when you take a step back from it, does he realise that it is actually sort of funny in its own right?
Oh, he loves it. He's incredibly proud of it and pleased with it. And
no, his original story.
No, I think so. Yeah, he's writing a book at the moment and which is called The Long Road to Wembley because obviously Bromley got to the FA Trophy final last year.
Right.
Which was the week before our Wembley premiere. And they lost.
Yeah, but even so,
they were 1-0 up with about 20 seconds of the 5 minutes of injury time left, and they let a goal in and lost on penalties.
It sounds like a really bad story. Someone should turn it into a film.
And then a week later, we were up at Wembley for our premiere, with a sort of star-studded premiere, up at the Bobby Moore Suite at Wembley for the movie. So it was...
Have been a perfect way to sort of dovetail the film, wouldn't it? You know, sort of Bromley winning the FA Trophy, you know, like fast forward 40 years.
Honestly, I was driving back from my in-laws that day and my wife kept, I was saying, what's the score? She said, which game? I said, Bromley, they're still one up. How many minutes? 94. So I'm going, yes, they don't know, of course. Then she said, it's 1-1 now. And you thought, well, you know, that's they're never going to get anything out of that now. And but look, all in all, a massive success.
Absolutely. So anyway, Dave Roberts.
Yes.
So he's written the story. He loves the script.
Yes.
So what happens next then when you tell us about the filmmaking process.
So you're right. The first thing is I adapt the book and turn it into a first draft of a script, which is about a 90-100 page movie script.
Okay.
And then we do, me and the producers, do a few back and forths on that about story and about some, you know, sort of dynamics of it all. Then a director comes on board.
Mm-hmm.
And the first director we had came on board. This was such a long time ago, he couldn't do it in the end. Had some meetings with him, and that was great. And we had some good stuff came from that. And then it stopped for a while just because of raising money for British indie movies is incredibly hard. It's raising money and keeping those investors in the project for the years it takes is so hard. So then TJ started to get a bit of wind up and it got it done, got the money raised.
Mm-hmm.
And we had another fantastic director joined us. And then we worked on the script for another 18 drafts.
Wow.
6 months worth of backwards and forwards. And that's a tough thing because it's your work.
What are the things that sort of like get drafted in or out? Is it sort of like a character that someone that isn't, a character isn't written well or some...
It tends to be what a director wants.
Right.
It's what is every scene to quickly move the story on.
Right.
Whereas a writer is more likely to pad around and make things.
See.
So I'll write a 4-minute scene that is completely unnecessary, but it's very funny and about non-league football. We all laugh, ha, ha, ha. And Steve says, do we need that scene? And I go, oh no, don't take that one out. He says, got to go, mate. And so it just goes, clunk, rip it up, gone. That scene's gone. And then even so right through to the edit that's happening, you'll be shooting scenes and then we'll look at them in the edit and think, that just doesn't... Hell,
doesn't work.
It's got to go.
I always think famously in The Italian Job, for instance, there's a bit where they're doing the car chase.
Yep.
And they end up in this huge, great big hall. And to the strains of Blue Danube,
yeah,
they've got the police cars going forward and back and the minis going forward and back. And then Peter Collinson, who was the director, he said, well, it was great and it was brilliantly orchestrated. And Remy Julian, the team who did the stunt driving, were fantastic. But his phrase was directorial masturbation and took it out. So...
Yeah.
He said it was great, superb, wonderful, but we did it for the sake of doing it.
And it's like a bit like that with writing, is that you have your little pet bits that you really love, and then they have to go because they don't. And the thing, feature film scripts are notoriously hard to get right in the middle 40 minutes.
Right.
The stuff setting a film up, setting a story up is quite easy because you're introducing all these fun characters.
Okay.
Finishing it, you've got your big crescendo coming up, but that bit in the middle is where most films suffer.
Right.
And so that is where a director has to earn his money, making that story interesting for that middle 40 minutes.
And tear what's left of the writer's hair out.
It is tough, it's part of the process.
You didn't thump him at any point, did you?
No, he's a lovely, lovely bloke, and he's done an incredible job. The film is way better than I imagined it was going to be, and that's all thanks to him. I had a film in my head. This is the weirdest part about the process, is that you have the film very strongly in your head, and then you see it on screen, it's not what I was expecting.
I guess, because I don't... I'm not totally unfamiliar with Bromley, yeah. And I think that Palace's training ground is nearby, isn't it? Beckenham, which are kind of neighbouring sort of districts.
Yes.
So it's kind of a relatively flat, sort of just below the Crystal Palace Hill, and it's actually a relatively well-to-do area.
Yeah, it's quite nice. Yeah. Hayes Lane, where the ground is, Bromley's ground now is lovely. And because the film is set in 69, right. 70, we couldn't shoot there because it's just beautiful. And
so where did you go?
Crocken Hill. Now, if you get a chance to Google Crocken Hill Football Club, it is just incredible.
Go on.
It just hasn't changed.
Where is it?
Crocken Hill is, I think it's near Sevenoaks. I drove there a couple of times. But you drive in and it looks like it hasn't been touched since 1950, let alone 69, 70. We had to paint it to make it look better. And we went in there and they were so lovely. We were there 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And we built a tea hut. We took all their advertising down. We built all our own advertising. It was amazing. And they couldn't have been lovelier. But yes, so that's the ground you see in the Bromley Boys is exactly as Crocken Hill looks pretty much now.
So obviously, probably the thing for them is that they'd have preferred for you to film it in the summer. But did you have to do that? And if that was a thing, because if you're going to film a football film, then it's got to be look like it's, especially non-league, where when you film non-league, it always feels like it's chucking it down and you're playing on a bog.
Yeah, and well, we shot it. I think they shot it in sort of September, October, which is the worst time, really, because the sun's out, then it's dark. Yeah. So your director is, when you're outside, constantly battling this sun, because that's the worst thing. But the glory of the football scenes. I mean, I'm a real stickler in football films for the football not looking rubbish, because it often, if I'm watching a football movie and I think, oh, hang on,
you've scored a screamer from five yards out.
I've seen so much football, I can just tell if someone's a footballer or not.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, someone who's seen a lot of football, I saw a film called Away Days, one of those awful hooligan movies from the sort of 90s. And I remember they shot it. It was supposed to be shot at Tranmere. That's what the idea they were setting up. And so they're in this stand. It was clearly a non-league stand. Mm-hmm. They're kind of angled so they could see the corner flag. Mm-hmm. And this player wandered in, sort of asking for the ball. It was just an extra to try and make it look like a game was going on. Didn't have a number on his back. I remember thinking, it's such a stupid detail to get wrong.
Yeah.
No one on the set said, hang on, shouldn't that football... And as soon as I saw that, I thought, do you know what, off.
Rubbish, yeah. Well, the thing is, Meme Machine, you know, the remake of The Longest Yard, Longest Yard, yeah. Vinnie Jones is obviously the main man in it, and he actually said, you know, obviously there was all his mates that were doing it, but everyone who did play in it, looked like they had to play football and looked like they had to play football.
And we were lucky in that we were trying to make it look like the worst non-league team in the country. So they weren't great, but that was sort of funny. That was kind of the point, really, that they were rubbish. And they were terrible.
But at least they were trying to. But it's a bit like the Les Dawson principle. You have to be good but look rubbish.
Oh no, some of them were rubbish.
Oh right, okay.
Our main guy, Ross, who played Alan Stonebridge, who's the sort of hero. He was a good footballer. He played a little bit of non-league football,
right?
And that shows when you watch the.
Oh, okay.
And he's the main person on the ball. We tried to keep it as little football in it as possible, really, because that, you know, it's hard. It's so hard to choreograph.
Mm.
If you are writing a script, the ball goes down the right hand side, swung in by Eric Nottage and headed home by Stonebridge. You try getting that shot. It's because the defenders need to look like they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
The winger needs to cross it properly. Mm. You could do that all day and not get it right.
Even in fever pitch, something like that as a penalty at a non-league ground. You think, how do you make it not look like a dive?
Well, I'll be interested to see what people think of the Bromley Boys, because I think it's okay. I'm happy with the football scenes.
But it's not as though you had rubbish taking up the main roles, was it?
No, we had the dad, Dave Roberts is played by an actor called Brennick O'Connor, who's brilliant in it. And he was in Game of Thrones was his break.
Okay.
And he played Ollie in Game of Thrones. I know, I've never seen a minute of Game of Thrones, but apparently he killed Jon Snow in Game of Thrones.
Okay, fine.
That's all I know. And his mum and dad were played by Alan Davis and Martine McCutcheon.
I bet they were a hoot.
Yeah, Martine's great, actually. She's, Alan Davis is what you'd expect, sort of slightly grumpy football fanatic. But Martine, of all the people... There, she's got something about her, Martine. She's got a bit of star power about her.
Should your wife be listening to
No, no, that's just fine. No, she's one of these people that when Alan kind of shuffles into the recording studio, Alan Davis there.
Yeah.
But Martine, for some reason, she hasn't done much recently, but there's something about her. She's a star. You know, and it's an interesting, you know, dynamic. But she's lovely, and she's
great. Cheeky smile across her face. Only seen her when the camera's on her.
Yeah.
But is she like that off camera?
She's like that off camera. Yeah.
Oh, really?
She's lovely. Okay. Yeah. And she was on the One Show actually the other day talking about it, which was good. She name checked me on the One Show. Bless her.
Well,
I was happy with that.
The Albion Royal and the One Show.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Absolutely.
She said yes. You mentioned me. I thought that was very sweet. I got lots of texts. which was lovely.
That's your boy, your girlfriend.
Yeah, Martin said your name on the one show, which was good. But no, it's, and you know, she loves the movie, which is the main thing. She's kind of excited.
Well, she's not going to not say.
Well, no, but you know, it's difficult with these people because often, I guess, you know, they all make a film and watch it and think, oh no, and then they, of course, you still have to do the months of chat shows and talk shows. And you know, Alan Davis was on with Brennock on Soccer AM at the weekend.
Okay.
And they were doing their plug-in, which again is such a surreal thing for me to sit and watch those two on Soccer AM talking about the movie I wrote. It's bizarre. Doesn't feel real, but it's great. So
how did it do in the cinemas?
Okay, it was a very limited release because it's just, you know,
because it's an indie film.
So hard to break through. We tried so hard to break through, but of course, you know, the big chains, you know, they are interested in the big blockbusters, mm-hmm. bums on seats. And we got it in, I think it was in 140 screens mm-hmm. around the country, but there were some smaller ones, a couple of big ones. It did really well around the area, as you can imagine, around South London. It had a good run.
Yeah.
I went to a couple of those screenings. Again, it's a real moment, going to the pictures and seeing your movie. It's good.
Did you have a big premiere?
Oh, Wembley. Yeah, Wembley Stadium. So that was all vintage cars and
and was that a sort of like a real sort of star-studded?
It was, look-ish. There was a few, not particularly. It's funny because I was kind of, in my dreams, it was going to be all my heroes. I was hoping to see Frank Skinner and Danny Baker and all the people I wanted to talk to.
Sure.
From what you get, of course, is a cavalcade of reality stars.
Oh, Towie lot and things
because
like that.
Because that is, you hire a PR company to bring celebrities to your premiere.
Yeah.
You get that because that's what gets papped.
Yes.
You know, so honestly, that was funny. They had the big board up and the green carpet. We had a green carpet, grass carpet thing. And so we've got these, you know, these gorgeous girls and men who look like they're carrying two imaginary carpets, walking in and getting paps. The paps are going, and then me and my wife were allowed in one of the cars because we were sort of key crew.
Oh, yeah.
And we walked in front of this thing and it just went, vroom, click. It was just so funny, excruciating. So you could hear this sort of tumbleweed. Who are these two? Yeah, but that was, again, we did that. And that
you didn't feel like just walking up the carpet and going, well, I'm the writer!
Well, no, it's a weird thing, because you know, your ego, such as it is, does want to say that when you're at a 1,000-seat premiere.
Yeah.
Full of, you know, you want, because no
one
knows
who I
am. No one knows who I am, because I'm just wandering about some old bloke.
Yeah. with your hired tux.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
No, it sounds like you had a good time, though.
It's been an absolutely brilliant adventure, and it is...
And it makes you want to do more.
It's a movie, isn't it? It's exciting.
Absolutely.
But
it's out on DVD now, isn't it?
Yeah, DVD and all the usual places. So you can see it on Sky Box Office, Amazon Video, Virgin Movies, all the usual download streamy places.
To be honest, it's about time I got that. I did try and put it on in Brighton at the various sort of theatres around and about.
Right, didn't we? Yeah.
Not interested.
Yeah.
Just not interested. Terrible. And I'm actually going to name check those. I'm going to say the Duke of York. I'm going to say the Dukes at Comedia. I'm going to say the Salis Benny. Those are the three that I sort of zoomed in on. I could probably find a pub somewhere, but you know, we have to pay licences and things like that. But I tried for these places, not interested in putting it on. Even just, you know, as an independent sort of promotion thing. Yeah. That, you know, obviously we pay the fees and everything like that. Bizarre. So maybe the club can put it on. We'll have a sort of big screen in one day. But above and beyond that, then you know, make sure you download the Bromley Boys on Sky Cinema.
Sky Box Office, Sky Cinema. Amazon, Virgin Movies.
Can you do it on YouTube? Because sometimes there's a pay thing.
I don't
for that
think
as well,
it's on pay YouTube yet. Don't think it's on there yet. But iTunes.
Okay.
All the usual places and DVDs from Amazon supermarkets.
So those wondering about their Christmas present this year?
Definitely get the Bromley Boys. The Bromley Boys, if I'm going to say one thing about it, it's a lovely family movie. And you can sit down Sunday afternoon.
Much swearing?
Oh, none.
None at all. Well, that's not a football movie at all, surely.
But it's a lovely, I've got a few people have said that. And a few people, a lovely thing I saw on Twitter the other day. Not that I trawl Twitter looking for Bromley Boys reviews. Believe me, that's not a great idea sometimes. But someone said they were sitting watching it with their mum and dad, and dad cried.
Oh, really?
And I thought, oh, that's
is that good or bad?
Oh, it's so good. It's such a lovely thing to hear that people have been got emotional at the end of it.
I remember that player. He booted me up there. So what is it? You've got something else coming out now as well,
yeah,
haven't you?
Incredibly typecast. All I do is football comedy.
No, that's so, fine. On a football a podcast?
Yes, I suppose so, yeah.
Absolutely.
A different thing, this, but again... Also exciting. I live in Seaford, but went to school in New Haven and lived around that area my whole life. And there's a group called the New Haven Regeneration Group, and they're trying to, as you'd imagine, trying to regenerate the town and mm-hmm. spending sort of money here and there, different projects. And I bumped into him, Mark, at my sister's, my daughter's art class.
Okay.
And we chatted about what I was up to and what he was up to. And I sort of said to him, look, we can help each other here. I could make you something. And so we went back and forth. And he said, yeah, go for it. And he just gave me a little bit of this fund and said, go make me some TV. So we've made Seaside Town, which is a 6 12-minute episodes about an American soccer star, Keely Jones, comes to visit the oldest football club in the country, or one of them, New Haven FC.
Is this inspired by Dave Roberts by any chance?
No, the thing is, obviously, you know, it is a little bit, Warren's making another football comedy, but
with an American girl.
Oh, yes, true. Yeah, it could be. That's a good shout. But no, we did that.
Okay.
You know, there's obviously reasons behind that idea.
Absolutely. Okay.
That you bring in, you know, it's going to be up on Amazon Prime soon.
Uh-huh.
And that the market for Amazon Prime, the main one, is America.
So
I just thought, do you know what? If we can do that culture cross clash comedy.
He's done a football comedy for the Americans.
Exactly. From the point of view of an American.
Based in New Haven.
Meeting these crazy characters in this little football, tiny football club. But I'm hoping it'll cross over.
So many people are going to be so disappointed when they see New Haven, though.
Oh, no, it's, I think I'm really happy with it.
But no, absolutely.
We'll see how it goes.
Because it's not the first gig you've done in New Haven, is it?
Football. No, that's.
No, there's another football story in New
Haven. Oh, yeah, that's the first thing I ever did. With my mate Matt.
I have seen that, and I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, that gets
it. Look, rewind 12 years here. I had a shop, and I think you lent me a copy of it. Remind me of the film title.
It was called New Haven Port, and it was subsequently renamed Come On You Chickens.
I thought it was called that. I was talking to Kieran before we recorded our bit, and I thought, hang on, I'm certain the title wasn't Come On You Chickens.
No, it was New Haven Port. And right. We did. We were so unlucky with that. We made this pilot, me and Matt, and we were so happy with it. About 40-minute sort of mock documentary pilot, and again set at New Haven Football Club, and we sent it off to a few companies, mm-hmm. and we got some unbelievably good responses, and we had a couple of meetings lined up. It was ready to go. Our meeting, London's world was, and we saw online that ITV had commissioned a series of Mike Bassett, England manager, series,
and they seriously unhelpful. Yeah,
meetings cancelled, end of project, because then they wouldn't commission another football mock doc at the same time. And that was it. All that work comes and you think, that was a...
I have to say this to you now, Warren. Having seen that, I think that there's, if not the timing for the market, then at the very least to have that resurrected and put out at the same time. Now, actually, tell us, you did say that you're doing a promotion in New Haven for Seaside Town.
Yes, we got like a lovely premiere day in New Haven. On next Sunday, we've got doing two screenings at 3 o'clock.
So that would be the 18th of November.
Yeah, we're doing 3 o'clock and 7 o'clock screenings at the sort of little sort of hall that we shot the final scene.
Which is where is this open to the public?
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we've got give us the details.
Yeah, we've got tickets left. We haven't got many, but it'd be fantastic to have some Albion fans there. That's what I would say. It's kind of lovely to have some friendly faces there. I can force to laugh at it.
Sunday the 18th of November.
Yes,
where?
The Hillcrest Centre in New Haven, which is a lovely little community centre, which we've got a big screen put up, and we've got a red carpet, and we've got everything going in. And you can find out about it at seasidetown.tv.
Okay.
You'll find
out. And the tickets are how much?
There. They are £12 and £4 for kids.
Okay. And you'll be doing a Q&A?
Our Q&A, a bar, meet the cast, red carpet,
fabulous.
Photo board, all everything.
Okay,
all
and having got a copy of the DVD that American lass, if I think she might be popular to be met.
Yes, her name, she's got an incredible name. Her name is Hanaj Bang Benz.
With a straight face. Are you sure she didn't just...
No, I said to her, my first question, after I cast her, she sent her tape in, she's great, she's her accent's immaculate, and so I... emailed her and said, look, can we Skype? And I said, Hannah, I'm going to ask you, is it your real name? Because she's a cage fighter as well. So I kind of thought that Bang Benz, but she's Danish. And her dad was a Bang and her mum was a Benz. And she's Hannah Bang Benz. But she's incredibly talented. But the thing is, she's completely not a footballer. She's never kicked a ball. So we had to work around that.
Fair enough.
A little bit, so we don't really see
her.
So
she could have been in the Bromley Boys as
well. But if you liked Come On You Chickens or New Haven Port, it's a very similar feel. Obviously, the bloke who's in it's the same bloke.
Right, well, therein lies my point is that, you know, I think that Come On You Chickens should be resurrected and put out there again. I really do think that, even if it's a supporting film, you know, that comes with it. Come On You Chickens, I thought, was brilliant.
I'll tell you what, I've got a link to it, so I'll send you, stick it out on the raw...
Please do. No,
happy
but
to
I, was,
do that.
I was trying to monetize it for you, mate.
I'll give you a link. You stick it out on the raw Facebook page or something.
You're on.
We can have a look.
Brilliant. And with that, I'm afraid to say, Warren, we're out of time. Oh, but thank you for coming in. Good
see
luck with
see you in 7 years.
See, whatever your next football project is. But good luck with the sales of the Bromley Boys,
yeah,
and hopefully be able to catch you with the Seaside Town. My name's Alan Wares. You've been listening to the Albion Raw. Thank you very much indeed to Warren Dudley. Thank you to Kieran Maguire. Aid will be back in the hot seat next week. Thanks for listening. Catch you later. Bye for now.
One night, Farmer Brown was taking the air. Locked up the barnyard with the greatest of care. Down in the hen house, something stirred when he shouted, "Who's there?" This is what he heard. "There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep, and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble with your chin. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. You're stomping around and shaking the ground. You're kicking up an awful dust. We chickens trying to sleep, and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble. It's a sin. Tomorrow is a busy day. We got things to do. We got eggs to lay. We got ground to dig and worms to scratch. It takes a lot of setting, getting chicks to hatch. Oh, there ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So quiet yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. Kindly point that gun the other way and hobble, hobble, hobble off and hit the hay. Day. We got things to do, we got eggs to lay, we got ground to dig and worms to scratch. It takes a lot of setting, getting chicks to hatch. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So quiet yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. And kindly point that gun the other way and hobble, hobble, hobble off and hit the hay. Hey, hey, boss man, what do you say? It's easy pickings, there ain't nobody here but us chickens.